Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you. Well, howdy, everybody.
Good morning.
So, welcome to our very final conversation about Always With Us, although the poor being always with us will continue to be in our conversations, right?
Yes.
See what I did there? That was good. So let's open with a word of prayer. Jesus, our sovereign, you assure us that you are with us always to the end of the age. You tell us that whatever we do to the least of your kin, we do it to you. Teach us to see you and serve you in the poor. Help us to know you and believe in you through transforming relationships with those in need. We pray for the sake of your love. Amen. So this is our final week with this particular book. So I'm going to give you just a little program note about where we're headed for the next handful of weeks, because it's not that many weeks before we take our Christmas cantata, Christmas break, right? And we've got November in there, which is also its own weirdness with Thanksgiving. So here we go. Coming up in November and the very beginning of December, we're going to shift a little bit. It's going to feel like less of a shift than it might have, because this book spent so much time in sort of the history of Jesus' life. But one of the things that you suggested when we talked about possible topics back in the spring was, well, we'd be interested in knowing kind of the world when Jesus was alive. And I did not say, well, Bible study is in the other room. But we're going to do, actually, it'll be a little bit of Bible study relevant material. But we're going to talk about contemporary issues, first century edition, right? So we're going to learn about the sort of the world that Jesus came into. Some of that, again, we've already covered from sort of the economic angle. We're going to talk a little bit on the religious end. What is it that people were expecting when they were expecting a Messiah? Because Jesus was not the only Messiah who was identified as such during his time period. So there was expectation out there that an anointed one was going to show up and change things. So what were people expecting to have changed? For two of these conversations, one of my religious studies professors from Grinnell College will be with us. He'll be with us on November 11th and December 2nd, because schedules. So on November 11th, Henry Reitz will be with us. He'll be talking about sort of why the Gospels say what they say, with sort of background of what were people expecting. Because if you know what people were expecting, the Gospels make a different kind of sense. So he's going to help the Gospels make a different kind of sense to us. And particularly the openings of the Gospels. At the beginning of December, I'm skipping some Sundays, I'll explain why. At the beginning of December, Henry will be back with us to talk to us a little bit about a contemporary sort of rewriting of, in this case, the Gospel of Luke, written in the context of late 20th century Mexico. So to take the ideas, the plot line of the gospel, but what would that look like in our contemporary world, in that particular contemporary world, in that case? So another way of sort of thinking into the historical context of the gospels, you have to really know the history in order to understand how that history would come forward. So I've skipped a couple of Sundays. We have... one of those Sundays is November 25th. We won't have class that day because it's the Sunday after Thanksgiving. November 18th, Brother Pitcher will be showing us sort of a feel for the place where Jesus was. So as we talk about all of this history, then you'll have some pictures to put on what we've seen and what we've heard and talked about. So it would have been great to have Warren's pictures like back in September, because then we spent all this time in the ancient Near East. But hey, you get what you get. So that'll be a chance to just sort of, I hope, solidify a little bit of the context that we've been talking about. Next week, I'm going to sort of bring us through the period after the end of the Old Testament, before the beginning of the New Testament. There's about a 400-year gap between the writing of the last Old Testament books and the events of the New Testament. And so I'm actually going to give you in the Covenant Corner email on Tuesday, I'm going to give you a YouTube link to a college lecture. It's so they do a different thing in college these days. They often have the lecture sort of as a video PowerPoint, and then in class they get to spend more time talking, which is great. So you're going to have about a half hour lecture. It's not super like lively, but it's rich and informative and will give you some material for thinking about that intertestamental period. Then we'll refresh that with a shorter video next week that gives kind of a quick synopsis of what was going on in that period between Malachi and Matthew. In your Bible, between Malachi and Matthew is a page that says the New Testament, right? And then sometimes the numbers start over. That can throw you off. But we're going to sort of dig in a little bit into what was going on in that intertestamental time. That's to set up the conversation with Henry on the 11th and sort of that shift into, okay, what were people really looking for? We've been sort of previewing some of that question too, with always with us on the economic side, what were people really looking for? You will also be thoroughly impressed because always with us has been focusing specifically on the gospel according to Matthew. There are four gospels, you know that. They were written in different places with different audiences in mind. You probably knew that. The good news is we are gonna start with the gospel of Matthew on December 23rd, and then we'll be in the Gospel of Matthew all the way up through Easter. So you are going to be super well-backgrounded on Matthew and what that gospel is trying to get at in its original setting. So you're going to be so smart by the end of this. Now, today we're going to be turning to the sort of from the main sort of argument of the book, we're going to turn a little bit to the conclusion and start talking a little bit about how we can work on addressing poverty as a systemic issue in our world today. Now, the book is still not going to be super sort of practical, here's what you should do, for a couple of reasons. One reason is that sometimes we just have to spend time learning the background before we can shift to what's practical. I'm going to introduce something that we'll talk about after Christmas that really does get very nuts and bolts practical. So how do we respond in the world that we are in today? So I'll introduce that at the very end. So what we've been doing is sort of the theological background before we can then turn to that more practical. The other reason that this book feels a little bit less than practical to us is that this book started as an academic dissertation, which you can sort of, if you've read any other dissertations that turned into published books, they sort of feel like this. They spend a lot more time on sort of the whys and the hows before they get to the, okay, here's what we've been doing. That is just sort of a piece. It's been present in the way that we've read the book, but I should probably have fessed up to that really early. So if it has felt really kind of academic, that's why. It is. So this book is an academic book presented to us as a popular audience. We're popular. But it began with real serious practical concerns on the part of Liz Theo Harris, who works with the poor and works on behalf of the poor. And so it developed as a response to sort of a counter response to folks in the church who Theo Harris finds dismiss poverty as something that it's inevitable or even it's divinely ordained, right? And they're quoting that line from Jesus in Matthew 26 when Jesus says, "The poor you will always have with you." And so they're quoting Jesus, but they're doing it wrong. So pay attention when people quote scripture at you, because it is very possible to do it wrong. So in Matthew 26, Jesus is anointed by a woman who anoints him with this huge quantity of very expensive perfume. The disciples are upset that she is wasting something so valuable that could have been sold and the money given to the poor. And as Jesus is correcting their way of thinking, he quotes this verse from Deuteronomy 15, saying, "The poor you will always have with you." So it's possible to take that verse wrongly and say, well, yeah, Jesus said there will always be poor people. We don't have to worry about that. Now, we don't want to say that we take that position on the poor, right? Or on the existence of poverty. We want to do something different with that. But Theo Harris wants us to notice that we've got some of the assumptions behind that in our own work with the poor. So then, of course, we went back into the original context of Deuteronomy 15, which is those commandments that would be hard to work with about the Jubilee. But the intent of those commandments, the purpose of the one who gives us those commandments, is that poverty should be eliminated, that we should eliminate structural poverty. And as we read that, as we listen to the poor, as they read this passage from Matthew, we recognize that all of this sort of fits into a pattern in Jesus' ministry that God intends for poverty to be ended. And then Theo Harris goes, sort of refreshes, this is all summarizing a conclusion, so the conclusion summarizes the things we've already talked about, this approach of reading the Bible with the poor. And I think there is something for us to really remember, that reading the Bible with the poor, not even just about the poor, but with the poor, really would enrich our engagement with Scripture. So it's not just enough for us to, as wealthy people, read the Bible and think about poor people. It is also important for us to be in relationship with the poor, and in relationship with the poor that takes them, their experiences, and their insights very seriously. So then we get to recap this story from Matthew 26 one more time, highlighting how the story illustrates Jesus' intention that that economic exploitation be transformed. And Theo Harris writes here, this is on page 151, "This prophetic leader," that's Jesus, "this prophetic leader does not pit the poor against himself. Instead, he suggests that the ending of everyone's poverty is his significant role and the role of other poor movement leaders. The foundation of the movement to materialize God's reign on earth is not the rich, not the big social service providers, not the sovereign who executes those who seek to transform society, but God's children, the poor who are working to transform society and improve their own and everyone's life. God is not only aligned with the poor, but is in fact present in and of those leaders and the movement of the poor." So Jesus is not presenting to us sort of a call to another government program that would change something and not really change anything, right? He's calling us to a movement that is actually rooted in the poor, that is rooted in relationships with the poor. Then she does one other interesting thing. Like, conclusions always have to sort of step into something new, right? So she offers to us one additional interesting detail from the sort of the end of the Passion narrative. So this is right after Jesus dies and right before Joseph goes and gets his body down from the cross and takes it and buries it. Matthew has this really interesting detail where the righteous people from before Jesus are resurrected when Jesus dies. This is in the tail end of Matthew 27. You don't remember that, do you? Yeah, it happened. It's in there. And so there's this really, it's a unique Matthew detail, but it is this this moment when Jesus' death is already the resurrection, right? Is already the beginning of something new, or the resumption of righteousness on behalf of, on the part of those saints who had died before. Theo Harris offers this to us as a sign of sort of the continuing movement that Jesus has initiated here. So in chapter 26, Jesus is handing leadership of this movement off to his disciples, but this resurrection before the resurrection is another sign that even though Jesus seems to have ended there, right, which he doesn't, that's what chapter 28 is, even though the movement seems to end there, it is already continuing, again, among the righteous who are the poor from before. So continuing movements, including the movement that we started with, that movement to occupy a shuttered church, way back from the introduction, when homeless folks moved into a church that had been closed by its church hierarchy. That movement is also, she says, a sign of that resurrection, the resurrection being the capacity of the poor to transform their lives and their communities. And so she says, what is most needed is for the church to have the faith to act. She says, we don't need more convincing. What we need is more resolve that we can stand up and act. So there's the summary of the conclusion, which summarizes and tries to point us forward. And now, so she's pointing us forward into what do we do practically? So what do we do practically? So first, sort of a summing up question about the book. So we've had this this approach offered to reading Jesus' words about the poor you will always have with you, to read those as fundamentally challenging the social and economic systems that we live in that create and perpetuate poverty. So what have you found compelling about that approach to reading Jesus' words, and where has that left something to be desired?
Repeat that question again.
What do we find?
It's like reading the book.
Yeah. So, what do we find compelling about what Liz Theo Harris has offered to us in this book, and what leaves something to be desired? Where do we not quite? Either we don't quite go to that place in the argument, or we see what she's saying and we wish it had gone even a step further.
I see more clearly that we're supposed to have the poor, especially in some broader sense, on our minds all the time. Mm-hmm. We're supposed to recognize that that's a basis of the gospel, not just an afterthought, like, how do you say, flipping somebody a coin?
Mm-hmm.
That's what struck me.
So it brings to mind the sort of the centrality of the poor in how we think about the gospel.
You got all in good words here.
Yeah, great. Excellent.
Well, we talk about the systems, you know, being bad for the poor. Mm-hmm. So she goes through all this, but she doesn't really have a suggestion for a replacement for the system.
Right,
and
yeah.
As I sit here and think about it, I think maybe that's the point, that it's not going to be solved by a new system. A lot of systems have been tried.
Mm.
You know, I mean, I was thinking about the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, supposedly that was Soviet Union, communism, everybody's common. That mm-hmm. didn't work out too well for mm-hmm. most of the people. And I think about maybe the people that have done the closest to this, maybe the Mennonites, I don't know, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They just kind of withdraw, you know.
Right, yeah.
Nobody's kind of suspicious of them. I mean, they got killed by the tens of thousands because people thought they were seditious to begin with.
Right, yeah. Well, when you say that there's a power higher than the state and you quit paying taxes to it, yeah. People have a tendency to really not be pleased. Yeah, so there's this issue of, is the system, I mean, is a system, are systems able to be just, right? And Tom's right, there have been other systems tried, and they haven't always worked so well either. And one of the ways that that sort of Mennonite approach to sort of withdrawing from the larger system, part of what ends up working about that is that it's a very small scale community, right? We can do justly to each other in this small setting more easily, more obviously than we could do justice even by the same practices at a larger scale. Now, there are also drawbacks to sort of the Mennonite approach and to ways that local communities work. So that's what the Book of Judges is about. So there are lots of, there are drawbacks even to the systems that we might really like. But there's this, is systemic change the answer? Is systemic change even possible? Betty, I saw your hand go up. It went back down. Fair enough.
If we're going to remember that as the poor you will always have with you, also mm-hmm. the unbelievers, the mm-hmm. Whatever we want to call everybody who isn't one of us,
uh-huh.
will always be with us.
Yeah.
I think we have to focus maybe on not creating a system. If a system won't work, I've got mm-hmm. I could go either way on that. We could create a system and tell people this is the way it's got to be just, as in Jewish law, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have to recognize that anything we're probably going to do, at least in the modern world, is going to have to be individual basis or individual effort or group effort among ourselves, among the believers.
Yeah, so there's sort of, if I'm hearing you right, part of what you're saying is is that sort of the modern world, the sort of the assumptions that we bring to our economic life out there, they just are, right? They're already set, and we as a group can't say, well, those are all wrong, now change it. We have to decide how we're going to operate within that.
We can only do what we can do. We can't make anybody else
right.
create a just system.
Right.
Well, what's just to you might not be just to the next person.
Exactly.
Right. So, how do we decide which justice we're going to pursue? Mm-hmm. Now, let me pause before we dig into that a little bit, because I want to ask the question of, okay, if the system is what it is, or the structural forces are what they are, So the if economics just sort of works the way economics works, with or without the government deciding that's how it should work, right? If economics works the way it works, and God calls us to eliminate poverty, so if poverty is inevitable, as we sort of have stubbornly refused to let go of, if poverty is inevitable, and God calls us to eliminate poverty, why? Why would God call us to do something that is impossible?
With God, all things are possible.
With God, all things are possible. So perhaps God calls us to do something that is impossible so that it doesn't have to be impossible. Right? Because walking on water is impossible if you're still in the boat, too. Ooh, see what I did there? Judy.
You have that last song that we sing at church.
Uh-huh.
And it's, excuse me, it says, you know, the angels aren't, you know, there to help. It's what we should do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm ashamed to say, but I just caught that, I don't know, a while ago, and I thought, oh my gosh, that's, I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. So the so it does seem to be the case that the angels are not sent into the world to do the work that we were called to do. Rather, we are called to do the work that we're called to do in the world. How does that relate to the idea that we are doing work that, sort of under the ways of the world, that work is impossible? If we're called to transform the world and eliminate poverty, and eliminating poverty is impossible, what does that say to us as people who are doing the work that we otherwise would think angels should do?
Well, we're probably gonna fail at it.
Yeah. And what happens when we fail at it?
We can feel guilty and sad. And you aren't doing what God wants you to do, but what can you do?
Yeah.
In other words, we don't do it because we know we're gonna fail anyway.
Well, yeah, don't try because it's
don't even
it's
try because we're gonna fail.
Yeah,
it's impossible. Or it just seems so enormous.
Right.
Where do you start?
Yeah. When is it that all of the saints of yore were resurrected and started walking around doing saintly things all over again? In the story that I just, and you said, I didn't know that was in Matthew's Passion narrative. When does that happen?
When
Jesus is crucified, when he dies, when he has failed. So who said we were supposed to succeed?
That just an assumption?
I think so. I think we are really good at thinking we should succeed. And we are really good at succeeding for the most part, right? Now, not necessarily at the things that the gospel calls us to do, but we are well trained in the art of succeeding. What if we were called to fail?
Well, that would be depressing.
Well, actually, we learn from our mistakes.
Uh-huh.
We learn from failure.
So we get better.
So if you don't ever make mistakes, you don't learn anything.
If you don't ever make mistakes, you don't learn anything. And so some of that is toward getting better, toward failing. Like, we need to fail early so that we fail less later on. So that's a piece of it.
But maybe we can learn from other people's mistakes, too. That might be better.
Learn from other people's mistakes as well, so we don't necessarily have to do the failing ourselves.
We can see those mistakes better.
Uh-huh.
We don't have to repeat other people's mistakes.
Yeah. Right, we don't have to repeat other people's mistakes. We can say, yeah, I see what happened there. Here's what I'm going to do. So there's a lot of value in failing, whether it's our own failure or someone else's failure. If we are trying to change the way the world works, if we're trying to change the way that people relate to each other, as we've gone through this study, we've had moments when we recognized, oh yeah, the ways that I interact with other people is actually sort of based on my assessment of where we stand economically. So the ways that I answer someone else's questions, or the recommendations that I make about how someone else should live, over and over, these are not completely based on, right? We have other ways of thinking that are all mixed in together, but they're always kind of flavored by, am I talking to an economic peer? Am I talking to someone who is above me on that economic scale? Am I talking to someone who's below me on that economic scale? And she was sitting like right over here, so I'm pointing over there. John, not John, Deb, talked about when she was a teacher and having parent-teacher conferences, and the parent-teacher conferences went differently with the very wealthy families or the very poor families. And the very wealthy families, of course, already knew all of the answers because they were up here on the scale and Deb was down here on the scale. Deb was here on the scale and the poor families were down here on the scale, and she caught herself interacting differently with them. So what if part of what we're called to do is not to succeed at changing the system, but to change how we interact? And to recognize not only other people's failures, but other people's wisdom. And the wisdom of the poor. That's a piece of what Theo Harris is trying to call us to do. So she's trying to call us away from these vertical relationships that she describes as patronage and dependency as she's looking back at the ancient world. But the vertical relationships that we find ourselves in, either as people on an economic hierarchy, as citizens of a nation, and what are the national programs that seek to address poverty, and do those national programs, state programs, local programs, or individual programs, right? Do any of those take into account the actual voices of real life poor people? And the actual experiences of real life poor people? So it's not just that we can be like spiritually enriched by conversations with poor people, but we can also be better partners with the poor if we have actual real life relationships with those poor people and take them seriously for what they've been able to do. So rather than these vertical relationships, horizontal relationships where we actually depend on each other. So, looking at today, looking at the world in which we live today, how do those vertical relationships of patronage, dependency, or other layers of sort of our vertical hierarchical relationship between the rich and the poor, how do those relationships perpetuate poverty today? What's going on that leads those vertical relationships to continue the cycle of poverty?
Well, the reason you're poor is because you don't do what I do.
Mm. Okay. So there's an assumption mm-hmm. in the way that we the wealthy address they the poor, that if they the poor would just do the things that we did, then they would be wealthy like us, which ignores a couple of important chance factors, right? Even if we really did make really good choices, which is not always the case. But even if we really did make really good choices, it ignores the chance factor that sometimes the same choice will have different outcomes just based on where someone happens to be standing at the time or what, you know, butterfly in Brazil is flapping its wings at the time you make that choice, right? The same choice doesn't always have the same outcome. And some of our starting lines are farther forward than other people's starting lines. And so so we have a tendency to neglect those. We also have a tendency to just try to turn people into us, whether we are actually helping or not, or whether lifting up this particular poor person into whatever bracket we happen to be in, maybe that's going to just, you know, pass the poverty on to someone else. I mean, there are lots of layers of that. That if we are the ones who are right, then we miss the chance to actually change the way that works.
I was having an exchange just yesterday, with a Facebook friend whom I've actually never even met, about. So that let us be honest with each other in the way this exchange went, mm-hmm. about what, well, it had Democrats mixed into it, but what we as Democrats could do to change things. And she was saying, well, let's not forget that the poor don't really get government money, except in very limited ways, like SNAP benefits, welfare, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. And I said to her, but I think that economically, we have to look at the whole scope, the whole arc of what the government does. If the government spends money to finish Highway 20 as a four-lane, somebody didn't get fed. If the government chooses not to fund schools, even if it's supposedly fair, that leaves somebody at the bottom of the pile. And that part of the failure we have as a society is to look beyond our own kind, which is part of what you were saying.
Mm-hmm. And so there's a... I want to see if I can pull on that a little bit toward these, toward this more horizontal way of relating.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you could make different sort of vertical arguments about whether Highway 20 should be finished all the way across, right? You know, and I'll be honest, a lot of my thoughts about whether Highway 20 should be finished all the way across are basically aesthetic. So I'm going to bring a bunch of stuff into there that isn't necessarily relevant, but... you know, we can have these sort of high-level, sort of top-down sorts of arguments about, you know, what should we do structurally, programmatically, and we can have those arguments without asking the poor how this affects them, right? Or we could have these arguments with each other, either arguments with ourselves as Democrats over here in John's chair, right? Or you don't have to be a Democrat to care about this stuff. Broader conversations about what do we do structurally, again, structurally at this societal, governmental level, what do we do about the poor? But what if you ask the poor? What if we actually privilege the voices of those who depend on something about the school or depend on something about Highway 20? And you know, if we're gonna weigh people's needs against each other, we need to hear from the people whose needs that we're weighing. I want to just lift something up. So I'm one of those, like, I'm a staunch independent. I only register with a party when it's a primary and I have to do that, right? And then I unregister and I re-register as an independent. But okay, so I'm feeling more and more left-leaning as time goes on, which is not to say that I'm right, right? It is to say that I get into a certain kind of dialogue with people who disagree with me. So this book was given to me by a friend that I was disagreeing with, and he was like, you need to read where I'm coming from. And whether this is precisely where he's coming from or not, I don't know for sure. But it sounds a lot like him. So this is not my friend, this is Arthur Brooks. So Brooks wrote basically an economic development case around alleviating poverty. So he said, hey, we've done amazing things over the last century reducing global poverty. So the number of people who, or not the number, but the proportion of people who live in really that breathtaking poverty. that proportion has gone down and down and down and down and down. And statistically, this is Brooks's argument, statistically the reason, the way that that has happened is that the world has become more prosperous. That there's more money, more wealth out there. And so as, it's sort of the rising tide lifts all boats argument, but he actually does a really interesting sort of assessment of, you know, the ways that our economic structures, even, you know, when we're talking, even if we, right, John and I over here, even if our, like, knee-jerk reaction is quick, write everybody a check. If that's what we're doing, we're still, part of what we're doing is we're making everybody's value economic, not human, right? So the thing that matters about a person is how much money they make. What if that's not the thing that matters about the person? Now, Brooks gives us a really interesting sort of case study from a particular community that he has an actual relationship with. His happens to be in India, ours happens to be in El Salvador, but there are ways that his thinking as, I mean, he's a conservative economist, that's what he does, but his thinking as a conservative economist is shaped by the ways that he interacts with actual, real, live, honest-to-God poor people. And I'm really influenced. I'm really drawn by the particulars of his argument. I find things to be desired in the particulars of his argument. But I think these folks are actually both doing the same thing. They're actually both trying to think at a large level based in the relationships with actual honest-to-God poor people. And so I offer that partly just to really try to reinforce that what we do practically is more than just a simple, you know, I've got the answer to the world that we live in, but rather that we need those horizontal relationships with not just each other, but with people unlike us, the other, whether they're other economically, other politically, other by religion or country of origin or what have you. We need those horizontal relationships with each other where we actually do depend on each other for the welfare of all. Now, very, very quick introduction to, we're going to look at this in January. This is where we'll finally get to, okay, what do I do? So this is Building the Good Life for All, Transforming Income Inequality in Our Communities. And this is a thinner book, and a more practical book in terms of, so starting with the idea that we are interdependent, starting with the idea that wealthy people and poor people depend on each other for common welfare and for our shared, my individual welfare depends on someone else's individual welfare. What do we do about that? And so it walks through sort of four broad sets of strategies for how do we respond. So it talks about relief, so the sort of, you know, quick send emergency bottles of water to somebody. It talks about self-help, how do we teach a man to fish. It talks about cultural formation, how do we sort of change overarching values and practices. And it talks about advocacy and governmental action. So how do we impact the political conversation, again, not partisan but political, how do we make decisions together as a society. Shannon Jung is the author, and he shockingly says some of these strategies work in certain ways in certain situations and don't work in others. Other strategies work in other situations and don't work in the first type. And so we need actually all of these different approaches. So I'm hopeful that this will maybe let the rubber meet the road a little bit on what we've been talking about. So we'll be turning to that in January. All of the interesting sort of contemporary issues, first century edition coming up for November and the first part of December. So I hope this has been a productive, challenging, insightful study for you. And I'll see you on a different topic next week.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.